is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We are looking for guys who are passionate youth basketball coaches, number one. But then that's not enough, because I meet too many basketball coaches, especially youth basketball, that have fixed mindsets, that just aren't willing to get out of their comfort zone, aren't really willing, or they're not passionate about growing themselves personally. So we look for guys with that growth mindset, with that entrepreneurial spirit. You know, kind of one of the things we do is what we call kind of like creating actual youth basketball careers for coaches. Historically, the only route really, if you wanted to be a youth coach, is like, okay, well then I have to be a high school teacher and then I can be a high school coach or a middle school teacher and a middle school coach. And that's great if you want to be a teacher in a school, but there was a lot of guys, they didn't want to be a teacher. So like, well, they just want to coach. And so what we've been able to do is develop a model that if it's the right guy, like we talked about, the right coach in the right city, we're able to help them create an actual career in youth basketball.
Brendan Winters is the co-founder of Pro Skills Basketball, headquartered in Charlotte, North Carolina. Brendan was a four-time all-conference player at Davidson College, where as a senior, Brendan was named an All-American along with winning Davidson's Tommy Peters Award, which is given annually to a male Davidson athlete who exemplifies excellence on the playing field and dedicated campus leadership. He was also named one of five national finalists for the Chip Hilton Award, which is given annually to a graduating senior NCAA basketball player who demonstrates personal character in all their affairs. After graduating in 2006 with a degree in English from Davidson, Brendan decided to pursue his lifelong dream of playing in the NBA. He was invited to attend the Portsmouth Invitational, as well as pre-draft workouts with the Indiana Pacers, Detroit Pistons, and Charlotte Bobcats. Despite going undrafted, Brendan continued his NBA quest by playing for the Golden State Warriors in the 2006 Las Vegas Summer League. Although he was asked to play in the NBA Developmental League, Winters decided to continue his career overseas, where he played five seasons before returning home to focus on pro skills basketball with his former Davidson College teammate, Logan Kosmalski. After you finish listening to this episode, please leave us a five-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Those ratings help others in the basketball community to find our show. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play so you never miss an episode. You can also visit us at our website, www.hoopheadspod.com. I hope you have your notebook in hand as you listen to this episode of the Hoopheads podcast with Brendan Winters from Pro Skills Basketball.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight, we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Pro Skills Basketball, Brendan Winters. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're excited to talk to you tonight, dig into your background as a part of a basketball family, and then go through your basketball career and get to what you're doing today with Pro Skills Basketball. I want to start by asking you how you fell in love with the game of basketball as a kid and what it was that you loved about the game.
Yeah, so for me, I think I kind of have a little bit of a different story than most, but you know, I guess you could say basketball. I was kind of born into basketball or into a basketball family. My dad played in the NBA, and he was drafted by the Lakers and played there for a year, and then was part of that big Kareem Abdul-Jabbar trade, where I think he was one of the four guys that got traded just for Kareem to Milwaukee. And so I was born in Milwaukee. I think about 2 years before he retired. So I was born in Milwaukee while he was a player. And then he retired a year or two after that. And we moved to New Jersey, where he got into coaching at Princeton. And then from there, it was just kind of one stop after the other. And so I was just, I mean, from the time I can remember, it was like basketball was the sport in our family. So just kind of fell in love with it that way.
How much time did you spend around your dad with the teams that he was coaching when you were a kid, when you were young? I know at some of the stops there, you were obviously real young, but at what point do you remember kind of getting around NBA players in the locker room and practices and that kind of thing?
Yeah. Actually, from a pretty young age. I mean, I think I was really lucky to to be in a situation where my dad was willing to bring us around. And then he was with organizations that were, you know, cool enough to let us come around. So my first memories are in Cleveland, actually, when he was a coach with the Cavs and Lenny Wilkins. And they used to play in this old Coliseum. I think it was called the Richmond Coliseum. You guys might be able to tell me, I'm not sure, but,
Richfield. It was way out.
Way
out in the country, which was the original. I don't know if you know the story behind the Coliseum, but it was originally built. The thought was, is that they were going to build it halfway between Cleveland and Akron, and that way they would be able to capture the fans in both markets. So that was the theory anyway.
Yeah. So I have memories of being there. They had a practice court up top there. And I mean, I was second, third, fourth grade, and we would go to practice and they had these big like AstroTurf rolls that we were at, like my brothers and sisters and I would come there and we'd kind of just crawl through them while practice was going on. It probably wasn't the best thing for kind of the players and stuff to be distracted by us. But yeah. And then after practice, of course, we would shoot around and stuff with the players. And as I got older, my dad went with Lenny Wilkins from Cleveland to the Hawks. And I was, you know, kind of like, I think I was fifth, sixth grade then. So that's when I started getting a little bit more serious about it. And I'd go to practice and then, you know, actually to work on my game a little bit rather than just kind of play tag and hide and go seek and that sort of stuff.
So was it tough to move around as much as you did, or was that just kind of the way life was at that point?
Yeah, you know what? I think the first move was hard. At least the first one I remember, which was Cleveland to Atlanta, because we had been in Cleveland, I believe it was 8 years. And so that was the longest we ever stayed anywhere, but that was only until fourth grade, like I said. So after that, it was 2 years in Atlanta, 2 years in Vancouver, Canada, 4 years in Denver, a few years in the Bay Area, in San Francisco, Oakland area, back to Denver. So we moved all over the place. I think I lived in 8 different places growing up. So, you know, I remember Cleveland being hard because I didn't want to move. But I have 5 brothers and sisters. So we're a family of 8, my mom and dad, and then 6 kids. So that made it a lot more manageable and, you know, easy, I guess, is because we kind of all had each other. And it wasn't like I was an only child that always had to go looking for friends and things like that. It's like I just played with my brothers and sisters if I hadn't met any friends yet or whatever. So we were a close-knit family that made it much easier.
So when you were a kid and you're moving around, what was your summer basketball? What did summer basketball look like for you at the time when you were growing up? You know, let's say even compared to how summer basketball is today, it's obviously exploded in the last 5 to 10 years. So what was it like? What was your experience like with summer basketball growing up as a kid?
Yeah, it was mostly just camps up until high school. Like I remember in Atlanta, I would go. My dad was good friends with Bobby Kremins, who was the coach there then. They both went to the University of South Carolina and played there. So I'd always go to the Georgia Tech camp. I specifically remember that one because I loved it. Just a bunch of different camps. I really didn't play a ton of like quote unquote like AAU. I did play some, but I, you know, that was mostly in the winter or in the spring. But yeah, summer was mostly camps. Until I got to high school. And then once I got to high school, I went to high school in Denver, Colorado. Sort of claim that as my hometown, just I guess because I did do 4 years of high school there. But once I got there, that was around like 97, 98 or so. And I think that's the time when AAU really started getting popular. I mean, they had like Adidas ABCD camp and the Nike camp. But that's when kind of, quote unquote, AAU got popular and so started playing AAU then, but definitely did not do that in middle school or high school or middle school or elementary school. It was just straight camps for me.
So you're in Denver for high school. Describe what your high school career was like, and then we'll jump from there into your recruiting saga and how you ended up getting to Davidson? Because I think it was kind of a circuitous route to make it where you did.
Yeah. So it was difficult at first. I got to admit. I mean, I was a good player. I was a good player in Ohio. I was a good player in Atlanta. And then we moved to Vancouver, Canada, and I was maybe even considered like a great player in Vancouver. Like I was one of the better players around. And you got to remember, my dad was the first head coach of the Vancouver Grizzlies, so he coached that expansion team. So now Canadian basketball is actually really good. I mean, if you look at the recent draft and
right.
a couple before, like there's really good players coming out, especially out of Toronto. But that wasn't happening very much because, you know, it was kind of the Grizzlies and the Raptors that kicked the kind of, I don't know, basketball revolution off in Canada. So I got up there and there were good players, but it wasn't anything compared to like Atlanta, Georgia. So I was a really good player there. And I mean, I worked and things like that, but I think I lost a little bit of perspective about how good maybe I was. So then moved to Denver, where my dad became a coach of the Nuggets the summer before my freshman year. And I was still a good player, but I definitely wasn't where I thought I was or where I wanted to be. So I was skinny and maybe a little bit slow. I could really shoot it. But showed up to Denver, Colorado, and I was good. I was one of the better players at my school, and it was a good school, but definitely not where I wanted to be.
So at what point do you start thinking about, you know, and obviously you've been around the game at a very high level with your dad. So when do you start thinking about looking around at your options to go and play beyond high school? At what point does that become, I don't know if reality is the right word, but at what point do you start looking at your options for what that is?
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, growing up, I was always like, I want to be an NBA player, but I mean, every kid says that. And even in Vancouver, you know, I started thinking about that, and I started thinking about college a little bit as kind of a seventh and eighth grader, just like, oh, I want to go back and play college in the States. I didn't know how long I was going to be there. But I think it definitely wasn't until I moved to Denver that I really started thinking about playing in college and wanting to be a college player. And I met a kid there who was also a ninth grader at my school who is still one of my, you know, is my best friend to this day. And he shared the same dream as I did. So we kind of started that dream, I guess, a little bit together. And it was in ninth grade, it becomes a little bit more realistic where it's not too far away. So, we just committed to it, man. And just we started working and we were pretty focused, you know, not a ton of parties and girlfriends and those sorts of things. I mean, it was all basketball, just work. So it was definitely ninth grade. Denver's kind of when I really, really got serious about it.
So as you started getting more serious about the game, and you're obviously spending a lot of time then in the summer working on your game and trying to improve, talk a little bit about your high school career, the level of success that you were able to attain there, and then how that translated into the college recruiting process for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was a struggle. My whole career was a bit of a struggle. I guess I started to have real success once I got to Davidson, but up until then, it was a struggle for me. Vancouver at the time wasn't great at basketball, but neither was Denver, Colorado, and Denver, Colorado still not to this day. I mean, it's not like a hoop haven or anything like that. So, I was a good player there, but I was always really skinny. I couldn't gain weight, a little bit slow footed, was still really growing. But I was willing to put in the work. So it was just, I mean, man, it was a slow grind. I mean, I was doing, you know, I was putting in as much work as my schedule would allow, whether I had school or didn't have school. But, you know, in the summer times, I'm putting in, you know, 2-3 times a day, doing 4 to 6 hours and mostly on the court. But, you know, I'm lifting weights and things like that. So it was just kind of freshman year. I played on like what they called, they had a sophomore team. I made kind of a big improvement that year, sophomore year. I played varsity, but really struggled on varsity and ended up kind of towards the end of the season not getting a ton of playing time. So that was super disappointing for me. Then junior year, again, was one of the main guys on the varsity team. Started to have some more success. And then senior year, was the guy on the team along with my buddy. And we both went, he went on to play at Cornell and then I went on to play at Davidson, but still, even then my senior year, like I was 6'4", 175 pounds and just, I hadn't really grown into my body yet. My skills were pretty good and I was relatively athletic and I worked hard and I was tough, but I'm in Denver, Colorado. I mean, there's not a ton of coaches like beating down doors of players in Denver,
right?
To recruit us. I mean, I think my class that year had like the largest, we had the largest amount of D1 signees in like the history of Denver. And I think it was like 7 or 8 guys. And I wasn't one of them. So what happened was like, I had D3, D2 offers. But I really wanted to go D1 and, but it wasn't a case where like, it wasn't necessarily like a D1 or bust mentality. Like a lot of the kids have these days. And, I mean, kids even had it back then. I was willing to go play D3 or D2. But I wanted to try to go play D1 and do as much as I could to go play. So what ended up happening is like, I really didn't get recruited very much, but my dad, he knew some people. So he knew Bob McKillop at Davidson and he knew him from, cause they're both New York guys. So he called up Coach McKillop, talked to him about me. We sent my tapes out there, Coach Matheny, who was a great assistant at Davidson, went on to be a head coach at Elon the past, I think, 8, 9, 10 years. Watched my film. They came out. They saw me play in like the quarterfinals of the state championship of the tournament, and I had a really good game. So basically, he left a message on my answering machine saying that they'd either they want me to come to Davidson, but they don't have any scholarships left because it was so late in the year. So either come to Davidson, pay for my first year in redshirt, or he suggested I go to prep school, do a prep year, and I'd have a scholarship after that. So rather than being locked into Davidson, I decided I would do a prep year. I had no idea what a prep school was. I'd never even heard of it or thought about it. But I was willing to do essentially what was a grade 13 at a boarding school to get it done. So I was a little bit young when I graduated. I was 17. So ended up going to Worcester Academy all the way across the country in Worcester, Massachusetts. Not the greatest city in the world, but the school was great. And we had an awesome coach named Mo Casera and assistant coach Jamie Sullivan, who's the head coach there today. And Mo went on to be a college coach, but got there. We had a really good team. Jarrett Jack was our point guard. He had come in from the Baltimore area. And we had Craig Smith, who played in the NBA for a little bit. He came from California, but we also had like 7 other Division I guys. So, I was a Division I guy then, and I had gained 20 pounds that summer. I turned 18, gained 20 pounds. Now I'm 6'4", 195. I'm shooting it better because I'm stronger. I'm just better because physically I'm just built out a little bit more, filled out. So then start playing against Jarrett Jack every day, one-on-one, 5-on-5, that sort of stuff. We have all sorts of coaches come in. And so then I start getting offers, Division I offers and actually become kind of a D1 recruit, D1 player. So that was probably the best decision I ever made, was to go to prep school and do that 13th grade. Even though I didn't need it for my grades or test scores or anything like that, it was purely a basketball decision. But I did it and didn't like it at the time necessarily, but I look back and that was definitely the best basketball decision I've ever made. So ended up committing to Davidson, because I felt loyalty to them. They were the first ones that kind of believed in me. And that was a big thing for me at the time. No one essentially believed in me except my dad, who thought I could be a Division I player. Even kind of my high school coach, didn't think I was a Division I player. But it was really just my dad and probably, my best friend who I talk about. So, I went to Davidson, loved Coach McKillop. He believed in me, thought I could play there, loved the school, was loyal to them. So decided to commit to Davidson, and that's where I ended up.
And then you obviously ended up having a really, really good career pretty much right out of the gate. So if you look back at your time when you were in high school in Denver, do you think that being in Denver, part of the lack of recruiting was you being in Denver, or do you really think it was just your physical development that you did in that prep school year that really made the difference? Or do you think if you had been, let's say, been going to high school in Atlanta, where maybe you would have had more exposure, played against better competition, that those offers may have come a little sooner, a little earlier, based on just your geographic location?
Yeah, no. I mean, I definitely think geographic location had something to do with it, but it was also me at the time. I mean, I was skinny, and I was a little bit of a mental head case as well. Like, I'd miss one shot and put my head down and sulk a little bit because I was pissed that I missed it. I thought I should make a shot. So
we see a lot of those at Head Start basketball camp. I don't know.
No, I'm telling you. So that's one of my biggest things today is when I see a kid like that, I was bad. Like, I seriously thought I should make every shot. It was ridiculous. I my mentality was totally wrong. My dad would try to talk to me about, of course, at a certain age, you just kind of stop listening to your dad, which was a little bit dumb considering he was an NBA coach and a great player. But yeah, so I mean, that was a big thing. But yeah, I mean, like, for instance, here I'm in Charlotte now, and around us, I mean, I think we have the most Division I colleges in the North Carolina area of like any other state or the region. There's a ton of them, so it definitely helps our kids to be around. And like I said, I mean, if you're going to Denver, I mean, you're taking a flight out there and all that sort of stuff. So, and it's not like it's a hotbed. So coaches aren't like, oh, I'm going to fly out to Denver this weekend to go check them out. You know what I mean? So that definitely hurt. So it was kind of the lack of eyeballs, but it was also then, I mean, frankly, the eyeballs that were there just didn't think I was good enough at the time. And I really wasn't. I think it mostly has to do with me because I'm a big believer in if you're good enough, they will find you. And especially nowadays, they will.
Right.
Social media and all that sort of stuff. So I'm a big believer in that. But I mean, the region does help. But I'm also a believer in basically failure, leading to the success I have. I don't think I would have been as tough, and maybe I wouldn't have wanted it as much if I hadn't failed and the number of times that I did growing up and had to go through those tough times and go through the fire and really force myself through it. All those days and nights I was crying, because no one was recruiting me and I wasn't where I wanted to be, drove me to put in those hours. And to me, it's kind of like that 10,000 hour rule. Like, maybe I wouldn't have put in all those hours that ended up later on down the road paying off. I kind of built that foundation through all those hours I put in that didn't pay off right away, but they paid off down the road. And maybe I don't put in all that work if I'm somewhere else and having a little bit more success and that sort of stuff. So I believe that, the reason I had success even right away at Davidson is because I put in so much work and so much time and wanted it so bad from that time, kind of those times growing up where I had all that failure, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. There's definitely something to be said for having a chip on your shoulder and trying to prove people wrong, whoever you want to quote people, whoever you want those people to be, whether it's coaches, recruiters, whatever. I think when you're trying to prove somebody that you're better than they think you are, being able to put in the work after that happens, I think is key to success. I know that I felt the same way in my career, kind of as being under recruited and felt like I could play at a higher level than what I was being recruited at, and saw a lot of the guys that I played with and against getting scholarships. And eventually I was able to you know, to get an opportunity to play Division One, and just happened to, I think, luck into being in a good spot where I got some opportunities and things turned out, you know, pretty well for me. And so I think that I had a similar story in that, you know, I wanted to prove people wrong. And as a result of that, just like you, I put in the time and the work and the effort. And I think that's what allowed me ultimately to have the success, because I wasn't the most athletic guy, I wasn't the fastest guy, I wasn't the biggest guy, I wasn't the quickest guy. But putting in the time, putting in the work, like you described, I think is what makes the difference. And I think that's something that I'm sure you use it when you talk to kids. And I try to use the same thing when I talk to kids, that, you know, you don't always have to be the most talented guy. You don't always have to be the guy who can run and have all these measurables. A lot of times your work ethic can set you apart from other people. And I think that's a great lesson for kids to be able to take away, whether you're, you know, a fourth grader, or whether you're a high school kid trying to, you know, earn your way to get a college scholarship or get an opportunity to play college basketball. I think there's a great lesson to be learned there from what you said.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. It's like compound interest, right? You got to make deposits every single day. And I made a hell of a lot of deposits, and you're not going to see that pay off right away. But a few years down the line, like, you will start seeing that compound interest. I think that's basically what started to happen at prep school, and then just kind of kept it, just snowballed into Davidson and into my pro career afterwards.
So what was your favorite part about playing for Coach McKillop at Davidson? What did you like most about him, his style, what you guys did there? What's your favorite memories of your time there?
Yeah, I loved how he was so offensive oriented. I mean, he's an offensive genius. And the motion style that he runs, he loved shooters. He loved guys that knew how to play and had an IQ, and he loved, you know, setting screens and things like that. So I mean, it was perfect. And he loved toughness too. And you know, I was a shooter, I was tough, and I had IQ. So I was able to be successful there. And then he put me in, like, I mean, the absolute best possible situations for my skill set. So that was my favorite part. But man, he is a hard coach. Like, you cannot be mentally weak and go play for him. And he got on me, and he's one, you know, he's the main guy that helped me kind of, I never truly overcame it. You know, I guess the non shit. I always wished I had a mentality like Steph, where he just missed one shot. He misses like 10 shots and he doesn't matter. I mean, he's going to keep shooting that ball.
Right.
But like, that just wasn't me. And I don't think I was wired that way. So he was really the first guy that, I mean, it wasn't just that he talked to me about it. He demanded that this next play mentality is he's had this forever. I mean, you know, for instance, before I got there, it was always, it's the whole thing with next play, you make a mistake, next play, you miss a shot, next play. I mean, I think it's kind of popular a little bit nowadays, but back then.
Yeah, it was definitely not as prevalent back then, for sure.
Yeah. I don't know if he came, or I don't know who came up with it. Maybe it was, I wouldn't be surprised if it was him, but that was it. And he didn't just, you know, talk to me about it and everyone, like, I mean, he demanded it. If you put your head down, I mean, he was in your face, and then you weren't on the court. So I had to learn real quick that if I wanted to play, I was going to have to get over that. So I did everything in my power to try to overcome it. Did a decent enough job. I still wish I would have done a better job. I think I would have been even more successful, but he did challenge me in that way. So offensively, that was, I mean, by far the best part about being there is it was just a great place for me as a player.
So did you see guys that came in, without obviously naming names, but did you see guys that came in that style of coaching, that level of being demanding that he would put on you mentally, that mental strain that he would challenge you with? Did you see guys that came into the program that didn't react in the same way you did, where that drove you to become better and push you and hit the right buttons with you? Did you see guys that came in and that style didn't work for them nearly as well as it did for
you? Yeah. I mean, it happened every year. I mean, every class, I mean, almost, you know, had one guy that kind of, like, he wouldn't make it all 4 years. And I'm not saying that's the right style, but that's just, I mean, Coach McKillop is an old school New Yorker. And that's just, I mean, that's how he was as a player, is what I've been told. And that's how he is as a coach. And he has kind of softened up through the years. Not to say he's soft at all now. He's probably a nice mix now, but I mean, he challenges his guys and, you know, both physically and mentally. And there's just some guys that don't make it. And it's like I said, I mean, if I hadn't gone through all that failure, before I got there, I might not have made it either, but, it made me want it more. It made me tougher. And, you know, I'll never forget the one of the worst parts is, and I think it's almost for every college basketball player, the preseason workouts. I mean, we would do these like four-man workouts, but when you're a freshman, they usually try to get you together the first few workouts just to kill you. And I had a workout with one of the other freshmen. It was just me and him. It was a 2-man hour-long workout, and they crushed us. And the other guy, he quit halfway through. I mean, like just went down, like said he couldn't do it anymore, went to the training room, lied down on the table, and like, I mean, essentially like passed out. And he ended up quitting. I think after his freshman year, he quit. He just couldn't make it. So I had to finish that workout myself, which was no fun at all. But I mean, it was those times where you got challenged and yeah, plenty of guys didn't make it, but that's also how it had to be at an academic school like Davidson, playing in, when I was there, the Southern Conference, and now the Atlantic 10, where it's, I mean, those are pretty dang good conferences, and you play some talented teams. So we always had to be like, you know, a little bit tougher and try to be a little bit more skilled.
Yeah, I think there's a good lesson there for, you know, a lot of times you'll hear kids who want to play college basketball, and I'm sure you've talked to kids and parents that are in this boat, and a lot of people just have no concept really of how difficult it is. And you just described basically one workout where if you put the average high school player through a workout like what you described, you know, they're not even thinking about college basketball anymore, those kids.
No.
And I think that's something that people just don't realize how challenging it is, both from a physical standpoint, like you're describing in the workout, and then also just the mental toughness piece of it, whether it's dealing with your coach, whether it's just dealing with all the time commitment and everything. And I know you guys do a really good job at Pro Skills of talking about the college recruiting process, so we can jump into that a little bit later when we get to that. But I think it's important for people to understand, just, you know, again, it's not a cakewalk. It's a difficult process, and there are a lot of positives and a lot of benefits from getting an opportunity to play college basketball. But I think a lot of people have they have misinformation about what it's like and how good you have to be in order to be able to play.
Yeah, no, that's one of the biggest things I think we deal with. A lot of people, again, especially with the social media these days, and I'm a huge fan of social media, but, you know, social media glamorizes college basketball a lot. And you see the ESPN stuff, and you see the highlights, and you see the amazing parts of college basketball. But it rarely shows the other side. Which is 95% of it, which is the incredibly hard work, the demanding schedule, the screaming and yelling, all the morning practices or the 3-hour practices or the workouts. And I mean, it just, yeah, it's so parents and kids especially have this misperception about what college basketball is, and especially Division I basketball. And because of all the money that's in Division I basketball, there's a ton of pressure on these coaches to win. And so when they're not winning, man, now that pressure is being passed on onto the players, and it is miserable. If you're in college and you have a losing season, it's a miserable time, because that's how those coaches are feeding their families that way, and they need to win or they're going to get fired. So as players, you know, one of the main things we try to pass on to them is like, look, it's amazing playing Division I basketball. Like, you'll have a scholarship most of the time. There will be some cool things, but it is mostly a grind, and it's going to be incredibly difficult. And if you're not tough enough to handle that, and if you're not willing to work and grind through it, like, you're not going to make it. We had a kid a couple years back that we knew He only wanted to go Division I just kind of for the ego reason. You know, like it was just everything on social media was just about D1, D1, and we knew he didn't really love it. If you don't love basketball, like unless you're incredibly talented, I mean, you're not going to make it. You need to love it. And this kid didn't love it, and he didn't get out of a preseason. He ended up getting Division I college scholarship. He didn't make it out of preseason his freshman year. He quit and transferred out of there. And so it's a hard place. And that message kind of does not typically get relayed to parents and players.
Yeah. I love that. What you said, that if you don't love the game, you're probably not going to make it. And I know that's 100% true. I can think of guys that I played with through my career, and there were quite a few that liked the game, didn't love it. And as a result of that, whether it was a year in, whether it was 6 months in, whether it was 2 years in, they just couldn't make it. And they didn't want to make it. And, you know, again, sometimes it's just not the right place for you or whatever. But I think if you don't have that love for the game, you're not willing to put in the time and put in the effort, you're not going to make it because of, as you described, all the demands are going to be placed on you. I know that you talked about earlier the fact that when you were a little kid, like most of us, you had dreams of playing in the NBA, and you obviously had a closer connection to the league through your dad. At what point when you're at Davidson do you start thinking that you may have an opportunity, a realistic opportunity, to play beyond college basketball? At what point does that set in that, hey, I got to start thinking about the fact that I might be able to play and earn a living as a basketball player here for a few years after I'm done playing in college?
Yeah. Immediately, that's one of the reasons I went to Davidson, is because they have a very long history of helping their guys play professionally, mostly overseas. We get a lot of foreign players there, and Coach McKillop does a lot of clinics and stuff overseas, and there's just a lot of connections over there. So I knew if I went to Davidson, I'd immediately have a good shot to play at minimum professionally overseas. So that was a bit of a factor. But of course, my goal was always the NBA. And, you know, I think my sophomore year, after that season is when I started kind of thinking about it a little bit, because I had a good freshman year. I think it was all freshman team in the SoCon. But at the end of the day, it's just the SoCon, right? Like, it's not the ACC. It's not the SEC. It's not the Big Ten. Like, it's the Southern Conference. So I had a good freshman year, but then I really made a jump into my sophomore year, and ended up being sophomore year leading the team in scoring and being one of the top scorers in the league. And I was up for player of the year. I didn't get it. I lost out. I got second to a guy, a really good player named Tim Smith from East Tennessee State. But as a sophomore, I averaged almost 18 a game, 17, 18 a game. So started to think then that I might have a chance, and had some pretty good games against some of the big teams we played, the North Carolinas, the Dukes, that sort of stuff. So saw that I could compete at a pretty high level. And then junior year, I was player of the year in the conference. And I think that's when I really started, you know, thinking like, okay, I have a legitimate shot at this. So I would say kind of, you know, around sophomore year and then definitely junior year, I think it really became a reality.
There's still time to register for the final Head Start basketball camp of the summer at Brunswick Rec Center. We'll also be having our Summer Skills Challenge at the Strongsville Rec Center on July 29th and 30th. You can find out more information or get registered for both of those events at www.headstartbasketball.com.
When you get done, what's the process like for you? Get a couple opportunities to hook on with NBA teams for various tryouts in summer league. Talk a little bit about that, and then how you ended up getting your first opportunity over in Europe after you kind of exhausted your NBA, you know, tryouts.
Yeah. So I ended up, I did three workouts for the Pacers, the Pistons, and then the Bobcats at the time. And I stunk it up with the Pacers. I had a decent workout with the Pistons, and I had a really good workout with the Bobcats. So I thought I had a chance to maybe get drafted by the Bobcats at the end of the second round. They didn't end up drafting me, but then I went and played summer league with Golden State. So played there, and actually my kind of buddy on the team was Jose Juan Barea, who ended up making the NBA. It was crazy to watch, because he was undrafted just like me out of Northeastern. And so, you know, we were kind of the low men on the totem pole, I think, coming from kind of like mid-major, you know, low major schools. Everyone else was, you know, I don't know, from the bigger schools. So Jose and I became friends there and hung out, but I just watched him. But I think once I got, you know, once I did the summer league, I just kind of realized, and I don't know if I admitted it to myself, but I just kind of, I was like, you know what, like, I think I might be in a little bit over my head at this point, and maybe Europe's a better option for me. I got drafted into the D League at the time, but I didn't want to do that because the money was so low, and I believe still is. So had some good options overseas. Just decided to go to France my first year. Actually my Davidson teammate, who was a year older than me, had sent in a highlight game film, and it was against us against Duke my junior year, his senior year. We both had really good games, and so that team like wanted me for like a whole year while I was still in college. So ended up going over to there to play with him in France, and played there for a year. And had a great time, and it was honestly like going overseas was life-changing for me. So amazing experience over there.
Yeah, very cool that you got to play with your friend. That I'm sure made the transition a little bit easier right out of the gate. I want to jump back, Brendan, before we continue on there. I want to jump back to the NBA draft workouts. So talk to people about what does a draft workout look like when those teams brought you in? What exactly do they have you do? Because I know a lot of times you hear before the draft coverage, oh, they're bringing this guy in for a workout, this guy's coming in, and that and this. Talk a little bit about what they actually have you do at a workout, what each of those teams did, or just what you remember about those workouts.
Yeah. I mean, they all vary in level of difficulty. As I remember, the Pacers was the easiest, and then the Pistons was kind of somewhere in the middle, and the Bobcats was the hardest. And funny enough, I did the best in the Bobcats workout. But some of them, like the Bobcats workout, was so demanding. I mean, we started with, you know, just to even kick things off, it was like, okay, let's see how many push-ups you can do. It was either in a minute or 2 minutes. And so like you just like crush yourself, and then they expect you to like, you know, shoot and do all that other sort of stuff. So, I mean, it was long and it was hard. So they vary in level, but in all of them, at least at the time, they could bring four guys in at a time. I'm not sure if that's still the rule, but there was always like one-on-one or two-on-two stuff as well as skill work. But then some of them, you know, would make you do sprints and kind of test your endurance and your fitness and probably your toughness. And then some of them were just all about skill and competing and that sort of stuff. So,
yeah, I think that people, again, don't necessarily have an idea of, just like we talked about with whether it's preseason workouts in college or the practice schedule or whatever, when you look at what the pro game demands, I think it's always interesting. People hear about those workouts, but they don't always necessarily know what goes into them. So thanks for sharing that. You mentioned when you were talking about that first experience going over to France, that it was a life-changing experience for you. So talk a little bit about what made that opportunity to go to Europe and play in France and continue on with a couple more years in Europe. What made that experience so life-changing for you?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't necessarily the basketball piece. I mean, it's definitely a different style of basketball over there. You know, like if anyone is listening to this and has played over there, you know, like the traveling calls and things like that, like you go over there in your first year, I mean, especially first few games, I mean, you you get called for 10 travels every in the game, you foul out of every game. Like, it's a different brand and a different style that you have to get used to. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's a fun game over there, and a lot of really smart players. And, you know, I think they, for the most part, play basketball the right way. It's not a ton of one-on-one. It's a team game and a skilled game. So that part was fun, but just, man, just off the court experience, a different culture, having to get out of my comfort zone and figure out how to buy groceries at the grocery store, and, you know, just different things, like, you know, waking up on Sunday thinking, you realizing you got to go get some food and then everything's closed, and, you know, having to deal with it. And so, yeah. And then, you know, trying different foods, meeting different people, just experience and everything over there that different cultures bring. It just broadens your mind, and just, it molds you into just a totally different person that by the time you come back here, you're just very different. And I think all in a positive way. So yeah.
Which country or city was your favorite in the time you were over there?
Oh man, I love, so I played my first year in France, and then I played 3 years in Germany. And then my last year I split between Hungary and Greece. Germany is by far like my favorite country. The people are amazing over there. Very English friendly company. The basketball was amazing. Because in each country, you know, they have different rules. Like in France, there was only two Americans allowed on the team. So it's two Americans and then, you know, pretty much 8 to 10 French guys or foreign guys. But in Germany, it's one of the countries where they almost do the opposite. They just say like, hey, you have to have 4 Germans on German passports on the team. So typically then you'll have like 8 Americans on the team. So it's almost like a better version of college basketball, like a higher level version of college basketball, which is, makes it really fun then. So that's why I had 3 pretty good years in Germany, and I loved it. So that's why I stayed there. And then my last year, like I said, I split between like, kind of outside Budapest, Hungary, and then, Thessaloniki in Greece. But, off the court, Germany, was amazing. I was in, Leverkusen for a year and Dusseldorf for 2, which are right there, right near Cologne, Germany. Couple hours away from Amsterdam, which is a great city. But Greece was also very, very nice. Thessaloniki is the second biggest city. So that's just a wild culture over there and a great country. And the people are nuts in a good way, passionate about basketball. So that was really fun too. That playing in Greece was just a much different experience than I had had, in any of the 4 years previous.
All right. We're ready for the craziest overseas basketball story that you have. This is a staple of the Hoop Heads podcast, Brendan. So give us your craziest overseas basketball story. We're ready.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few of them and more than a few, but probably only a few that maybe are appropriate for the podcast. But, one of them involves that probably, you know, a good one to tell is about PJ Tucker, considering, you know, the success that he's had in the NBA. And it kind of, I just saw like he was nominated, you know, as like, you know, like all stylish team or whatever, you know, he likes his shoes and his clothes and his outfits. So so my last year I went and played outside Budapest, Hungary, in the Hungarian league. And it was a good league, not great, good. I was playing really, really well. And then I got hurt, hurt pretty bad. I ruptured ligaments in my ankle, a lot of times the team will just cut you, 'cause they're like, man, you know, we can't deal with this injury. We need to get someone else who can actually play in here, but they wanted to keep me. So I stayed there and rehabbed for like 4 months. But they did bring in someone to take my spot while I was out. Well, he came in and played really well. So when I was ready to come back, there was 4 of us, but only 3 were allowed to play in the game. And so it was just a weird situation. So where one of us was sitting out every game. So I was like, you know what? I just told my agent, or asked my agent, I was like, hey, if you can get me out of here, just get me out of here. I'll go play, finish up somewhere else. So he called me up, told me that there's, I played for Aris Thessaloniki, and whoever's listening to this, do yourself a favor and go on YouTube and type in ARIS basketball, ARIS Greece basketball, and like, and fans, I guess, because they, I mean, there are some crazy fans over there. I mean, those are the ones that are lighting the flares in the stadium and chanting and going nuts. And, you know, I'll actually tell it. So one of the, probably the craziest thing that happened on the court was, well, first I'll tell the PJ Tucker story. So I'm going to Aris. I find out I'm going to Aris. I said, okay. So they said, hey, you're going to replace a guy named PJ Tucker. I was like, oh, okay, I know who PJ is. He played at Texas and, you know, good player. I was like, okay, cool. So I get in there and they take me to my apartment. And they're like, okay, you have PJ's apartment. So I get there. The other guy on the team was Bobby Brown, by the way, who played on Houston and was in the league for a little bit. I think we just most recently played in China. Great guy. So we had a good team. So I get to the apartment, it's PJ's old apartment, and there's, I mean, I get in there and I'm like, oh man, look at this. Like, he just left, like, I mean, he must have left like 10 to 15 pairs of shoes there. And it was like, it was my size. So I was like, oh, this is perfect, man. I got shoes and nice shoes too, like exclusive stuff. I ended up looking up some of them. I'm like, what are these shoes? And they were like, they were expensive, like Nike, you know, and Nike Dunks. So I was like, oh, this is great. So, so number one, he just left like a ton of stuff there, and I just started wearing it. I thought that was cool, but come to find out, PJ's a bit of a wild guy, and just kind of, you know, he just plays by his own rules a little bit. So I guess the story was that PJ was, I'm not sure if it was just that he was upset with the coach, or he was upset because the coach was this Serbian guy, he was a tough, really tough guy. He was either upset with the coach or also I think the team, it might have been a little late paying him. And so PJ just decided one day, didn't tell anyone, and just decided that he was going to buy his own plane ticket and just bounce. And so he just bought his own plane ticket, packed up, I guess, whatever he could, left other stuff and just bounced and went back to the U.S. and just didn't tell anyone. And I guess they had practice the next day and just showed up. Where's PJ? No one knew. Didn't show up. And I think he didn't show up the next, of course he didn't show up the next day. And they're like, okay. So they sent someone to his apartment, and then they end up finding out that he was just gone. And so that's, I think, when they were like, okay, well, let's try to save a little bit of money, and we'll bring in this Winters guy. So then I came in to replace him. But yeah, so that's just kind of, and then a year later, PJ was in the NBA. But I had heard so much about, like, all the teammates were just talking about how good PJ was. And I was like, oh man, I was a pretty bad replacement for him. But yeah, I mean, the next year he was in the NBA. So, just kind of interesting how it works. Apparently
you had his shoe collection though. So
yeah, no, I went home with some great shoes. So that was pretty cool. But,
nice.
You know, this other kind of crazy story real quick in Greece. We were playing, we ended up finishing, I think we were finished third or fourth in the regular season. And in Greece, the championship is always between Panathinaikos and Olympiakos. I mean, they're the guys that paid, you know, $7 million to a former NBA player or current NBA player to come over there and play. So it's like, it's never even a contest. So like all the Greeks, a lot of them refer to like the real championship as third and fourth place. So we played in that. And we played, not only did we play in it, we played our crosstown rivals that were in our same city. So, like I said, the Greeks are nuts and passionate basketball fans. So that was absolutely the wildest environment I've ever played in. They would not let visiting team fans in to the arenas because they would get killed. it happened the year before or 2 years before where someone died, like a visiting team. So you would go play at home. It was great. Like, you weren't going to lose at home because it was just all your fans and they were lighting flares and throwing stuff at the other players. And, you know, but you go to the other team's place and you get spit on, you get like batteries thrown at you. You got, I mean, it's like legitimately dangerous. And then like, I actually didn't like playing in that environment. It sucked. I was so happy for that, where you sit on the bench and like that you have the cover behind you. But
right.
In one of those games, there was kind of two different types of flares. One was just like a flare, and that's all it does. It's fire and flares up and smoke. Then there's the other one that at the end has like an M80 on it, essentially, and just blows up. And so we were winning at their place at the end of one of the games, and they threw one of those, and it slid across the court and came into our huddle. And we all saw it, and just we all took off running, and it blew up in our huddle. And like, I mean, it jacked some people's like ear up and stuff, like ears up, like just from the sound.
Right.
And we had to run out through the tunnel. They stopped the game. They told everyone that if they threw anything else on the court, they would just call it and we would win. So they didn't throw anything. We finished out the next few minutes. We ended up winning the game, but at the end we called a timeout and said, hey, when the buzzer sounds, like, just take off through the tunnel, because it's going to be a shit storm, basically. And, like, so that buzzer sounded and we ran, and it came down, man. I mean, just it, like, everything you can imagine. They just threw whatever they could get at us, and we ran out of there, and we were getting shelled. But it was really wild, man.
What is it about batteries? Because I think you're the second person that's told us that batteries get thrown at. Why are batteries readily available and used to throw at players? That's what I want to know.
I don't know, but I mean, like, mostly what they have is if you YouTube these videos at the beginning of the game, they throw these like receipt paper spools, and they take like the sticker off them, so they unravel, and it kind of looks like it. Actually, I always used to think it was like, oh, they're throwing like toilet paper, and it's just streaming down there, but it's like, it's receipt paper. And so sometimes what they do is they won't, they'll leave like the sticker on it so that it doesn't unravel, and it's just like a rock.
Yeah,
and they'll throw
that.
Yeah. I mean, I got hit by one, and it really, like, it doesn't, it hurts, man. And so, like, but if you Google, like, or if you search on YouTube for that and see that, like, you will see these fans, and they are wild, man. And it really is crazy. It's funny now, but at the time, like, I was legitimately scared at those places.
I believe it.
Yeah.
That is crazy. I mean, everybody to a man who has played overseas has one, two, multiple stories, some of which can be told on the podcast and some of which can't. But those were very good, Brendan. Those were outstanding. Those were outstanding stories.
Thanks.
All right, we're going to transition from your playing career into what you're doing now with Pro Skills. So talk a little bit about how you guys, you and Logan, how you came up with the idea to get it started, and then how you've been able to grow it to the point where you've gotten it now.
Yeah. So actually I was really lucky. The guy I played with in France is my Pro Skills partner, Logan, also a former Davidson teammate, all that sort of stuff. So we played together in France and then went our separate ways for a year. I went to Germany, he went to Poland. And then my team wanted to re-sign me. And Logan and I had the same agent. So then we ended up playing again together the following year. My team re-signed me and Logan. So it was there when we started talking about doing a basketball camp. And that's where the name Pro Skills Basketball came from. 2009, we did our first summer camp. We formed a company in Germany, in Dusseldorf. I'll never forget that. And called it Pro Skills Basketball because we were pros. Our idea was like, hey, let's get pros to this camp, teach and be counselors and college guys there. So did that summer, had a week of boys camp, and the next summer we did a week of boys and a week of girls, and they got bigger then and we liked it. And then the following summer we did 2 weeks of boys, 2 weeks of girls, and got big again. We liked it, and we kind of started looking at kind of the year-round kind of full-time model, like, what does that look like? And we knew some people who were doing it, so we were both ready to retire about the same time. He had done 6 years and I had done five. We were both kind of having knee issues and just a little bit worn out mentally, ready to kind of move on, get back to the States. And we had this thing, and so we were like, okay, well, we were lucky enough where we had some money saved up from playing overseas. So we weren't under any pressure to come back and start making, you know, a living right away. So we said, we decided, all right, let's go back. I think this was about 2012 ish, and let's do it full time and give it a year and kind of see how it goes. And so that's what we started doing. And we kept the name, we started it in the North Charlotte area. That's where Davidson is. And because we figured that was kind of our best shot to get kids there, is, hey, two former Davidson players, blah, blah, blah. Like, people still somewhat knew our names, although Steph Curry was by then a much bigger name.
Kind of overtaking you guys.
Yeah. But that's okay. I think he had some bigger things to do than run some basketball camps in the Davidson area. So we did that. And, our whole idea was like, hey, let's just do the kind of clinics and camps and workouts and that sort of stuff, that, kind of skill development sort of stuff. And we started training this group of sixth grade boys a couple times a week, and it grew to kind of like 20 kids, and they were having a good time. The parents loved us. So then it ended up asking us to form some AAU teams. And we were like, we thought about it. And we were like, all right. I mean, I guess that's what you guys want to do. And from there, once we did that, so we called for tryouts and put together some AAU teams and kind of took our skill development model and things we had learned from Davidson and overseas and tried to implement that into the AAU model, where it's like, hey, you're going to practice twice a week. It's not going to be father coaches. We'll hire our coaches. We're going to really like focus on individual skill work and not run a ton of plays and things, just kind of try to teach you how to play, not focus on just crazy, getting all the best talent and just winning games and just rolling the ball out and letting them go play. It was much more structured than that. It was, how can we teach life lessons through basketball? So took that kind of and put that into the AAU model, where it's like, okay, we'll do what we want to do, but you can also play games and we'll do that. So we called for tryouts and ended up kind of like having a line out the door, and we were like, oh man, what is going on here? we put together, like, we were definitely not ready for that. We got some questions like at the door that we were like, man, are you going to play YBOA, USSSA, USPA? We're like, man, I don't even know what you're talking about. But we put together four or five teams, and everyone really liked it, and we had a great time. And so I think we kind of realized, okay, like that's what we want to start doing. And then that's the route we're going to go. It's been about 8 years since then. And, we have 117 teams this year in six different cities, and we have probably over 100 camps as well in over 10 plus cities. So that's kind of the route we've taken over the last 8 years, is really focused on the AAU teams and the camps.
So that first year when you guys put together the first teams, did you guys coach those teams yourselves, or did you at that point hire a guy or two? Or did you guys just do it yourself that first year when you made the teams?
No. I mean, we were doing everything ourselves, and it was like the coaching version of what I did in high school. It was like 15-hour days, where it was like,
right,
in the summertime we'd have summer camp, and from, we'd be there from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. or 4 p.m. Then we'd have workouts for an hour or two from 4 to 6, and then we'd have practice from 6 to 9. I mean, we put in some really, we were just talking about it the other day. I mean, we put in some really long, hard days, as coaches on the court. In order to build it up, I mean, we each coached multiple teams, and we ran the camps and all that, because we were pretty obsessed with the quality of it all. That was, that still is a big issue in youth basketball. It's just the lack of quality coaching and teaching, and I mean, even just customer service, like answering emails and phone calls and that sort of stuff. So that was a huge thing for us. So we probably put in more hours than we maybe needed or were normal, but we did that. And we did it all when we first started.
What was the first thing that you put into somebody else's hands that you said, okay, we want to grow, we got to be able to delegate this camp or this team or this job to somebody else? What was that transition like? Because obviously you're very concerned, as you said, about the quality of the programming that you're putting out there, and you believe in what you're doing. So in order to put that in somebody else's hands, you have to, that's a big leap of faith. So talk about how you went about doing that and what that was like for you guys the first time. Maybe you weren't hands-on, the director of the camp, or you weren't right there in the mix and you were letting somebody else put your brand on their chest and do something underneath your brand. Talk about what that was like.
So I mean, it was a difficult kind of, it's been a learning process, and it hasn't been easy because both Logan and I are control freaks. We're very detail oriented, and we want everything to be perfect. But I mean, from the start, we decided we'd hire our coaches. So we hire our coaches and we pay them. So there were teams right away that we weren't coaching. Now we did kind of oversee them and oversee the quality, and we would work with the team still, but we did hire, out coaches, and we continue to do that to this day. And then from there, it was like, you know, hey, this guy's a really good coach. He would be a really good camp director. Okay, well, let's hire him and train him to be to run a pro skills camp. And then we let him go. But I think the big, we never had this dream or goal. Like when we first started to do it, we were like, hey, you know, maybe we can be like big in the North Charlotte area. And like, that's fine. We'll do it for a lot of years. We weren't even thinking about all of Charlotte or all of North Carolina. It was like really just like, hey, we can be big in North Charlotte, and like that's cool. But what happened was one of my you know good friends that I played against in high school in Denver. He ended up going to play at UC Irvine, and he was another kind of he was just like me, man, like a 6'4", 6'5", white guy shooter. Not the most athletic, but really could shoot it. And was skilled. He went to UC Irvine, had a great career, and then played in Spain for 6 years. And so we would come home in the off season to Denver. And then we would hang out more and more and more, work out together. And, cause our schedules were so similar. So we really grew close. And so then when I retired, I knew he was close to retiring, but he wanted to do at least one more year. So the first year we did pro skills here in Charlotte, he stayed overseas in Spain and played another year, but then he decided he was ready to call it quits. So I convinced him. He was in the same situation. Hey, he didn't have to, you know, make really any money year one. So I was like, hey, just come live with me in Charlotte. Help us run pro skills. We need some help at this point. It's grown a little bit after year one with his teams and stuff. So he came and he lived with me for a year and worked with Pro Skills for basically $0. And then at the end of year one, I mean, we always knew he was going to go back to Denver because he's a Denver lifer and just loves it there, which is fine. But we thought maybe he'd give us like 2 or 3 years. At the end of year one, he said, hey, like, I want to go back to Denver. Can I bring this back there? And we were like, yeah, sure. Like, he's an awesome coach. Like, I mean, he was with us the whole year. He's the first guy we really were like, pretty much like, hey man, do whatever you want. Like, you're awesome. And like, he agreed with everything we did. So we just said, yeah, man, sure. Go to Denver and do it and kind of take our website and structure and all that sort of stuff. And he started taking what he learned and what we did in Charlotte and took it back to Denver. And then that thing started growing. And so then we were like, you know what, like maybe we have a little something here that kind of can scale a little bit, that can grow, that can go to other cities. You know, it's not just about Logan and myself, and it's more about our culture and in our mindset and our values, and then just, you know, then finding the right guy who believes in that stuff, has the right background, finding the right city that is in need of it and that sort of thing. And so Ross Schrader in Denver was the first guy that happened with. And then from there, we've been able to find a few other guys here or there and in some other cities and things, and have gone about it that way.
So talk a little bit about how the transition went from, obviously at the beginning, you're just two basketball guys who love basketball and, hey, we want to run some camps and kind of give back and do the things that we're familiar with. And then all of a sudden, well, it may not have been all of a sudden, but at some point you transition to where you're no longer just basketball guys. Now you're actual business guys and entrepreneurs, and things kind of shifted. I'm sure your day-to-day of you're no longer spending a 12-hour day out on the court. Now you're doing all the business side of it, whether that's the website, whether that's the promotion, whether that's coordinating between multiple cities and multiple locations. So share a little bit with us about what that transition was like, and then kind of what you do now, 8 years in or 9 years in, however long you are here, what you do on a day-to-day basis to keep Pro Skills where you guys are, what you're continuing to do to try to continue to grow it.
So I don't know exactly when that was, but yeah, I mean, we've been lucky to have some really good business mentors. Some of them are, you know, parents of kids that played for us. Some of them are just people we got connected to through one way or the other. But some advice we received pretty early on is just, you know, you always got to try to replace yourself in your business, and you know, get out of the weeds, so to speak, and kind of, you can't always be stuck in the grind and on that kind of hamster wheel. After a few years of those long summer days, and then, you know, all the falls and the winters and the springs and that sort of stuff, I think it really hit us that, one of the first things we did besides, you know, for Ross going to Denver, is we hired a part-time administrative assistant. Like, hey, we need some help, like answering phones and emails and that sort of stuff. So we hired a part-time administrative assistant, and then, she grew into a full-time. So we started kind of finding ways to replace ourselves and especially the stuff that, like, we didn't really like I don't love answering the phones or answering emails with questions that are pretty easily answerable if you just look on the website. So stuff like that. So we hired that person, and then we started hiring, like, we found guys who loved to be on the court and just be coaching and all that sort of stuff. So we found those guys and started hiring them to run a lot of the workouts and direct camps. And so slowly but surely we started replacing ourselves. And yeah, I think it's been 2 years now, really, where I've been completely in the background and Logan's been completely in the background, just all, like, purely on the business side. Now we still do a lot in terms of basketball, especially we deal a lot with, like, basketball quality. Like, for instance, Logan is doing, like, a lot of online courses that our coaches take. I'm overseeing our city directors to make sure the quality is kept up on our teams and things like that. So we're still involved. I mean, because we're a basketball business, we're still involved in basketball things. But we also, you know, I do a lot of the marketing. We're having to build budgets now and all that sort of stuff. It's like almost like we both got kind of like our real life MBA or something like
right,
that
right.
without going to school, which is cool. It's been really, really fun, actually. Not all fun, of course. It's been ups and downs and things, and it's been hard and challenging, but it's something new and something refreshing after, 30 years or so of just, basketball, on the court. It's been refreshing over the last number of years to get into something a little bit different. Like you said, the entrepreneurship, the business side of things, learning how to do a budget. I was the bookkeeper forever. Thank God we have a bookkeeper now, you know, like right. just little things right. like that. It's those jobs. Like, I learned how to do them up to a certain level, but then it got to a point where it's like, okay, I'm beyond my expertise. So then again, replace myself with someone else. And, so it's been fun. It's been challenging. It's been refreshing. And we both really, really like it. And Logan and I are very different people, personality wise and all that. I mean, we have the same values. We believe in the same things and in the same, we want to build the same culture. So we're alike and aligned on the things that really matter, but we're different enough to where, I think our strengths and weaknesses complement each other. And we've tried to, take our strengths and then do, put ourselves in roles where we're going to be successful, and then kind of take our weaknesses and figure out what those are, and then take ourselves out of those roles.
Yeah, it's great to be able to have a partner that you can work well with, that your strengths don't necessarily overlap, and yet you still share the same values and the same ideas for the long range vision of what the business can become. And I think it is interesting that, you know, you transition from strictly being, okay, we're a couple of basketball guys doing some training and some camps, and then now you're into this whole other world that provides you with challenges. And one of the things that I always find to be interesting, and I think Jason and I have found this a little bit with the podcast, is, you know, if you're a person, and I look at myself as a player, and I think that from talking to you tonight, I get the sense from you that, you know, putting in hard work and having that type of work ethic as a player and in the early stages of your business when it was all basketball, now you've been able to transition and apply all those things that you learned as a basketball player into what you're doing now as an entrepreneur. And I think we talked about, you know, learning a lesson earlier for some of the things you said. I think this is another great lesson for players who are out there listening, that, you know, the things that you learn, and for coaches too, you've mentioned a bunch of times that teaching life lessons through the game of basketball are so critical, that when you have that work ethic that you can apply in the game and then take that and use it in other aspects of your life, like you guys are doing now, to me, that really is what is exciting. Like, I love doing all these other things that are, you know, that obviously the podcast is basketball related, and yet at the same time, it also has all these business components of marketing and social media and figuring out how the technical side of it works, and how do we get guests and scheduling and all that type of stuff, that has been a lot of fun for me and for Jason to be able to learn how to do that. And you guys have obviously done that on a greater scale as well. I want to give you a chance. We're going to wrap up here in a second, but I want to give you a chance to give us a 1 or 2 minute little commercial about Pro Skills and what makes it so unique and special in the youth basketball world today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, real quick too, I just want to, you know, I guess piggyback off what you were saying before too, is like, I think it comes down to like having a growth mindset. You know, like being on the court for 15 hours a day or 8 hours a day or whatever, like we just realized it was not going to be sustainable. Especially we both, you know, we started to get into serious relationships and then ended up getting married, and now we both have kids, and we were like, you know what, like we need to be home with our wives and our kids.
Wait, hold on. You want to see your family? Is that what you're saying there?
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing, like, you know, right?
So it was like, you know, we can't continue to do the evening hours and the weekend hours. Like it's not, again, it's not sustainable. And so I think we always had it in us, but we started realizing it's just having a growth mindset, where it's not a fixed mindset, where you want to learn new things and you just want to grow. It's like what you guys talked about with the podcast, like just so many areas that, you know, you probably didn't know a lot about before you got into it, but it challenges you in a new way, where, you know, basketball coaching, it's not all that challenging to me, just because I was lucky enough to have some great coaches, and I pretty much just take the best parts of them.
Right.
I mean, but like the business side, and, you know, learning the marketing and the bookkeeping and the administrative, I mean, that was the difficult part for me, but that was the challenging part. And that's a big part of our culture, is we are looking for guys who are passionate youth basketball coaches, number one. But then that's not enough, because I meet too many basketball coaches, especially youth basketball, that have fixed mindsets, that just aren't willing to get out of their comfort zone, aren't really willing, or, you know, they're not passionate about growing themselves personally. So we look for guys with that growth mindset, with that entrepreneurial spirit. You know, kind of one of the things we do is what we call kind of like creating actual youth basketball careers for coaches. Historically, the only route, really, if you wanted to be a youth coach, is like, okay, well, then I have to be a high school teacher and then I can be a high school coach, or a middle school teacher and a middle school coach. And that's great if you want to be a teacher in a school, but there was a lot of guys, they didn't want to be a teacher. So like, well, they just want to coach. And so what we've been able to do is develop a model that if it's the right guy, like we talked about, the right coach in the right city, we're able to help them create an actual career in youth basketball that can support them, that can support their families. And now it's hard. It's not easy because it's not like opening up a, you know, a McDonald's where it's just like day one, people are coming. I mean, you have to build it. But if you have that entrepreneurial mindset, if you have that willingness to grind and work and hustle and all that sort of stuff, you can build it to a nice little business. So while also, you know, pursuing your passion, which is coaching and impacting the youth and teaching them life lessons through basketball. So it's kind of the best of both worlds where you're able to get paid to do something you love and you don't have to do. We've built up a team behind us. We have a couple full-time administrative assistants. We have a marketing team. We have an HR team. You know, we have some teams behind us that basically we find these guys and then we put our team behind them, where they don't have to go out and build that team up over the next 10 years. It's like they can come in day one, they're going to have it behind them. And, so it's been really nice being able to help some of these great guys out there, do that. And then, you know, we're able to impact thousands of kids now, which is really, really cool and pass along some of the best stuff we've learned. So, yeah, we'll see where it goes, but we've enjoyed it, and it's kind of building the plane while we're flying, so to speak. hopefully we don't crash, but we're sort of flying right now. So we you know, every once in a while it gets a little tricky, but it's really been fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, I know that. I think I found your guys' website, I don't know when, maybe 2013, 2014. Just as I was looking through and I was writing a blog that I haven't done as much since I started doing the podcast, but I know since then, just I've kind of followed you from afar and watched the growth, and it's been pretty amazing. I want to wrap up here, Brendan, by giving you a chance to let people know how they can get in touch with you, how they can find out more about Pro Skills. And then if there's anything else that we didn't hit on that you want to share before we get out of here, you can go ahead and do that as well.
Yeah, sure. Pro skills wise, I mean, it's proskillsbasketball.com, and we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook. You can just Google Pro Skills Basketball and or search that on those various platforms, and you should find it. I am also on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. Again, you can just search Brendan Winters, and there's a few other Brendan Winters out there, but I think I think you should be able to find me, and I love to connect with people. So feel free to hit me up, hit Pro Skills up, and then, you know, follow us and we'll all try to grow the game together. But I don't have anything else. I mean, I think what you guys are doing is awesome. I've listened to a bunch of your stuff now, and Mike, it was great to meet you at the Billis camp. That's always nice. And I mean, that's one of the cool things about what we do is go to whatever various events or just meet other like-minded people in this kind of youth basketball business. And that's been one of my favorite parts of this whole thing, actually. So I appreciate you guys having me on, and it was great connecting with you both, and we'll have to get you on our podcast too at some point.
Yeah, for sure. Brendan, we can't thank you enough for spending almost an hour and a half with us tonight. It's been a pleasure. It's been great to be able to learn more about you, learn more about what you're doing with Pro Skills and how you were able to grow it from just a couple of camps into, you know, now you're in multiple cities across the country, and I think only good things ahead. And as you said, it was nice to connect in person at the Billis camp. And again, thanks for jumping out with us, and to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our Academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.